So what is the source of beauty? Someone tell us. Who or what is the source of all beauty?
God.
God, yes. All that is beautiful comes from God. God is the source, first of all natural beauty. We have a theme verse here. Marvelous are thy works, O Lord. That was a sign in my gospel sign mailbox post one summer. And I took a picture of it, and I thought, well, it fit with this topic. God is the creator which made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that therein is. And by his own declaration, it was very good. Now, I did want to say this, too, before I got going. And that is, I know you've been listening to a couple other topics this morning, so I've got the kind of a bad slot here. Just before lunch, you're all getting hungry, and so I'll try to hopefully make it interesting enough I can keep your attention. But anyway, I know you just had a break, so I hope you're ready to listen again. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, "He hath made everything beautiful." And then we have Psalm 104, verse 24, "O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches." And then our theme verse, "Marvelous are thy works, O Lord," Psalm 139. Now, as we think, we are thinking primarily about natural beauty, but I was driving up here this morning and I had some notes about another kind of beauty. And I thought, if we can talk about the universe and about the earth and about all the beauty that is therein, and we don't talk about this kind of beauty, we've really missed it. Because there's a more important kind of beauty than what we're talking about in nature. And that is, God is the source not only of all natural beauty, he is the source of all spiritual beauty. And I was thinking about the songwriter, this children's song, where it says, "Let the beauty of Jesus be seen in me." And I was just thinking about how, you know, without Christ, I'm sorry, we're ugly. And I don't care how beautiful we make ourselves on the outside, without Christ, we are ugly. The Bible says that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. And so all that is ugly in the world is from sin. When God created the world, he said it was all good, everything good. But sin entered the world and despoiled what is fair. As a hymn writer says, "In heaven where no evil thing cometh to despoil what is fair." And I thought that hymn writer had the right idea about what sin does to God's creation, has done to God's creation, and it did it to us. So when we become a Christian, all that ugliness is changed to beauty. Can you believe it? Christ came to make us beautiful. And we look at ourselves and say, "I'm not beautiful." Well, if we become a Christian, we become beautiful in God's eyes. And I know that as we go on in our Christian lives, we find sometimes some things that are not beautiful. Christ's image, his beauty in us can be marred. And I would have to hang my head in shame and acknowledge that too many times I have marred the beauty of Christ in my life. And probably we'd all have to confess that. And the thing about it is, I was thinking about this on the way up, and it's so wonderful, though, that as Christians, we can continue to change. We can continue to be made more like the image of Christ. I was reading those verses this week in the book of Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 3, I believe it is, where it says that we can be changed into the same image. What? From glory to glory. So, as Christians, in a spiritual sense, we're made perfectly beautiful. But then there's also that side of where we can become more beautiful as we put on Christ. And it talks about looking in the mirror there, in a glass. Well, what's the mirror? Well, we know it's the Bible. When we look into God's Word, we can be made more like Christ's image. And that's my desire. I think that's every Christian's desire. And I know this isn't really an evangelical message necessarily, but you know, if there's anyone that's ugly inside, has never been made beautiful, that opportunity is here for you right now. today, this minute, you can be made beautiful. It just, you need to repent and have faith in Christ, and God will make you beautiful. So I just wanted to look at that. And this beauty is far greater than any beauty in any part of the solar system or on the earth or any planet or atom or whatever you want to look at, fluorescent rocks, buttercups, butterflies, whatever you want to look at. This beauty is surpassing beauty. Now, there's one other aspect of this beauty that I want to talk about, and I just wanted to say this. What does the Bible call it? Especially in the Psalms. Let us worship the Lord in the what? Beauty of holiness. That's it. The beauty of holiness. Psalm 96, 6 and 9. And the beauty of holiness, you know what that comes from? It's because it's the beauty of truth expressed in life. That's holiness. And again, you know, that's what we all want to put on as Christians. We want to put on that beauty of holiness. And so hopefully this topic can help us do that. Now, I wanted to think about one other thing yet, and that was the glory of heaven. You know, I've thought about heaven in relation to this topic in the past already, and I thought, you know, what do you think of when you think of heaven? You think of glittering mansions and golden streets, and there's a pearl at every gate, and all those gems that are in the foundations and so on. We think, wow, can't wait to see the beauty of heaven. Great. I'm sure that will be very beautiful. But really, the beauty of holiness is far more glorious. And when it says that the Lamb is the light, is that light a natural, a physical light? Or is it the spiritual light? Is it the beauty of holiness that illuminates the whole place and illuminates our lives? No sin, no death. I saw some of the effects of sin. Everything that's in the world that's ugly is because of sin. Well, I saw a number of dead deer along the way up here. That's ugly. Death entered the world because of sin. But the beauty of holiness is far more glorious because it is God's glory. So have we considered heaven in this light? Are we going there for the mansion that we're getting? I've got a mansion just over the hilltop. Oh, that's great. But is that really what our main purpose is as we think of heaven? I'm challenged to be clothed in the beauty of holiness now, and we can enjoy that beauty in time to come. So what? God created natural beauty, and he created heavenly beauty, spiritual beauty. What is the purpose of all this beauty? Psalm 104, verse 31b says, "The Lord shall rejoice in all his works. Thou hast created all things," Revelation 4:11, "and what? For thy pleasure they are and were created." So God created these things for his own glory and for his enjoyment. And you know, he has given us the privilege of sharing a little bit in that. We can't begin to fathom the infinite extent to which God gets glory from his creation, but we have gotten a privilege of sharing a little bit of his pleasure. While we think about this in this focus today and last evening about nature and the beauty of nature, we must remember to worship the Creator and not the creation. The creation speaks of God. It calls attention to God, but it is not God. That's the pantheistic fallacy, that the creation is not God. God is immanent, that is, he indwells in his creation, but the creation is not God. And so we worship the Creator and not the creation. Many heathen have worshiped the creation, but we're a level above that. However, do we actually glorify God for his creation? Do we ascribe to him glory and honor and majesty? Revelation 4:11a says what? "Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power." That is the purpose that we have. And the psalmist says, "I will speak of the glorious honor of thy majesty and of thy wondrous works." Now, looking at the basis of beauty, how many are familiar with the word aesthetics? All right, there's a number here. How many would want to try to spell it for me? All right, we won't ask that. But anyway, the aesthetics is a study of the creation and principles of art and beauty. And so this is somewhat of a philosophy of beauty, maybe thinking about the basis of beauty. Someone has defined beauty as the combined qualities in something that gives pleasure to the senses or pleasurably exalts the mind or spirit. So it is interesting that beauty in nature and beauty around us is not only a physical sensation that is our eyes or ears, but it's actually touches who we are. It touches our person. It touches our being. It's in our soul, and it's in our mind and spirit. Now, it's primarily the natural we are considering, so it's sensual, that is, through our senses, and not in an immoral way, but rather it does please the senses. Now, I'll raise this question. I always like to ask audiences this question. Tell me, is beauty objective or is it subjective? That is, does it depend on who's looking at it? Or is it always, these things are beautiful and these aren't, all right? So you think it's subjective?
It's both.
All right. Oh, that's one way to slice it. It's both, he says. Oh, you can't have it both ways. Well, maybe you can. Let's think about this. I think you're right, really, Andrew, there. It is objective from this standpoint. Now, I believe in a creator God, and I believe that God has established some principles. When these principles and laws are followed, we're going to try to talk about a few of those principles. When they're observed and followed, then you can have something beautiful. So surely everyone would agree that a striking sunset is beautiful. This is a picture my son took when they were on their honeymoon in Grenada a few years ago. And that, I think we could all say, well, yeah, that's a beautiful sunset. Nobody's arguing about that. We all agree. So in that sense, it's objective. Now, it is subjective in that, or as our brother said here, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So let's look at this. Rattlesnake skin, is that beautiful? How many think that's beautiful? Ah, I got a good number. Yeah, not everybody would maybe agree with that. Anybody know what this skin is?
Coral.
That's a coral snake. That comes, I think, from Bolivia. But anyway, that's a deadly snake that if it struck you and bit you, you could die and I don't know, 30 seconds, it wouldn't take long, you'd be dead. But there's kind of beauty there, I think. My son has it hanging on the wall in his bedroom. That's the wall there he has it hanging on. So if you come there, well, you probably don't want to go in his bedroom. But anyway, there's a lot of rocks around there and such like. So what I want to point out here, though, is some people might look at that and shudder and say, that's ugly. I never want to see one of those in my life ever. And other people might say, well, yeah, look at that. I mean, the diamond pattern, and this one here is kind of roundish like it, and it is kind of neat. I think it's pretty in a way, its own way. So, yeah, there is something in the beholder. Now, not only did God create beauty, but he established the basis of beauty. God has created our senses. So I'd like to think about how we perceive beauty here a little bit and just run through that real quickly. Now, God could have made everything utilitarian. That means that it does its function, and it doesn't have to look pretty. It just does the job. And so God instead made things beautiful as well as functional. And aren't we glad? That really adds beauty to our lives because God made it beautiful as well as functional. Think about a flower. I mean, the flower parts wouldn't have to be beautiful in order to reproduce the flower, but God made it beautiful for our enjoyment and his own. And so it's not just utilitarian. God created the colors. We were looking at colors like in the fluorescent rocks, you know, all those colors would say, ooh, yeah, the gray ones, not so nice, but when you flip the light on, boom, the colors pop and you say, that's beautiful. All right, so we have the colors that he made. But you know, we wouldn't want an orange world. What if our world were orange? Wouldn't that make you feel a little on edge? Those are maple leaves in the town of Schaeferstown that I took one day. It probably has a sunset mode on, so maybe it's a little oranger than they really were. But anyway, we wouldn't want an orange world all the time. But God has balanced the colors so that we have flashes of orange, and we're glad in the fall to see these colors and to enjoy these. So it's nice to see these sometimes. These are leaves that were out along my driveway somewhere, I think. But anyway... So we like to see that sometimes, but most of our world is green and blue, and we like that feels calm and restful for us. So God gave us the gift of seeing so we could look at things like this and enjoy them. Also, God created sounds and the beauty of harmony. We sing, we singing songs this morning, and the beauty of those sounds that we can hear, all the principles of music, and we can rejoice in the beauty of the bird songs. And I brought one along here just to play for you. I didn't have it in my computer here. How many know what bird that is? Go ahead. Right, that's a common loon. Yep, that's a common loon. And it's interesting how these sounds can kind of bring back memories. My memory of that sound is one morning when we were on a trip. We stayed in the Lake Tahoe, California area. And it was in June. And we were tending out there. And we had not really planned for cold weather, forgetting that it was at 5,000 feet. And that night, it got down in the 30s, and we just had these little fleece sleeping bags. And I tell you what, we were cold. We were finding whatever we could to wrap ourselves in and try to warm up, and we were still cold. My daughter says, yeah, she was warm, and I guess my wife must have piled enough of things on her. But it was cold, and that morning the loons were going on the lake there. And so I always feel cold when I hear that sound. It just kind of touches your memory like that. That's the way the senses are. You can get these in your mind like that. God created the sense of smell. And I think this is a flower. I'm not 100% sure, but it's not the flower picture I want it here. It's, again, the memory, the sense that we have. When my wife and I were in Puerto Rico 10 years ago, we were hiking in their rainforest area, and there was this flower that just smelled, oh, so fragrant. And I said, you know what? I think if heaven has a smell, it would smell like that. And I think it was this flower. I think I took a picture of it just for the record. The picture's not that great, but it just reminds me of that. There's a kind of flower that we have. It's like a bottle brush type of flower. And when that thing blooms in the summertime, you can smell the breeze just brings that smell to your ears. And you just kind of inhale, and it just really smells so good. It's just a wonderful scent. The August lilies, that's another one that really has a powerful scent that you can smell. I just love to smell it on the breeze blowing and just touching your nostrils. And it is just, I often think of a Lucy Larcom's poem, "The winds my tax collectors are, they bring me tithes divine, wild scents and subtle essences, a tribute rare and free." You can smell those things and enjoy them. It doesn't cost you a penny, and that's worth a lot. God created touch. No, I have one before that. I'm sorry. I was jumping one here. God created taste. My daughter likes to make different foods out of different cookbooks, and whenever she does, then she likes to take pictures of them, so I think these are all hers. But anyway, I know lunch is coming up, so I'm going to make your mouth water. Well, or maybe they're not. I don't know. Maybe you wouldn't care for this kind of salad, for example, with the avocados on, but some of this, hopefully something will tickle your fancy there. I'm sorry, we don't have it at the buffet today, but anyway. The taste and smell go together. How would it be to eat food that had no taste? You know, just be plugged in like some astronaut and get the food. You can get all the nourishment out of some, you know, IV line. You don't have to eat. But God created the foods that they taste good. And we love to eat, and we see the picture, and it kind of all our senses work together, and then we see the picture, and our mouth starts to water because there's a beauty. And then there's, beyond that, an actual, you know, there's ways to prepare food and arrange food, put it on the plate, serve it, and all these things contribute to the beauty of the food. And sometimes it seems like, oh, you know, maybe they spent a lot of time making something special. Maybe they decorated a cake, and you're thinking, must we cut it and eat it and destroy it? Well, come on, that's what it's for. But so it's nice to save it with a picture. At least you got the picture then that way. There's some of these senses we don't think about as much are actually some of the more powerful senses, like smell. If you study memory at all, the memory sense and memory, like the sense of smell and memory, are closely related. And I talked about hearing the loon and feeling cold, but the sense of smell, that'll bring up, if you smell a scent again, that you had smelled sometime and there was some powerful emotion or something affecting you, that smell, if you smell it again, it'll bring memories back in your mind. It'll just pop that up. The Bible talks about sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. It's the best thing the psalmist could think about to eat. And so God has created these senses that work together, taste and smell. Without smell, you know what it is when you have a cold or your sinuses are congested. Food doesn't taste very appetizing because you can't really taste it without smell. They work together. God created touch, the last one we're familiar with. Sensations of touch and hot and cold. We can feel the breeze in our faces, and we can feel the splash of raindrops. We can feel the softness of pussy willow. And I just took a picture of this hickory tree of shagbark in my woods with, those shagbarks on. Can almost feel it, run your hand down over there and feel what that's like. The trees have a texture, and people that are really into trees, you know this texture, and you can identify what all they are by the texture of the bark. And it is interesting to run your hand over that, and it gives a beauty in the wintertime when the leaves aren't out that you don't see the other times as much. So God made all these senses. That's the part of the basis of beauty, that we can enjoy beauty because of our perception that God has created. Now, I want to move into this, the laws of design or certain principles. I said there are some objective things that I believe God has created. So, if there's anyone here that really likes modern art, okay, I hope I don't offend you. But I do feel like the nothingness of modern art, this is my opinion now, the nothingness of modern art is expressing exactly that. They're saying there is nothing. There's nothing meaningful. There's nothing lasting. There's nothing eternal. There is no God. So we can do it however we want to. And so to me, when I see one of those things that just swoops around and has no point or purpose and doesn't follow the principles of design, I think it's meaningless. And that's what they're expressing. Meaninglessness. It's the modern philosophy that it just doesn't matter. So when we talk about a law in nature, we mean God, the way God works. There are no laws in nature, it's just the way God works. And God always works the same way. Now, of course, he can alter those laws if need be. That's what we call a miracle. But the laws of nature are God's working. God has established these principles. So design is the organized arrangement of materials to satisfy a functional or artistic purpose. That's a quote from the encyclopedia. So we have certain elements. They are lines, they are planes, textures, colors, shapes, forms, volume, mass, space. So we have several things to look at. We have repetition. So when I was teaching school, there was a simple art pack that went over some of these things, and I know my art's not really good, but they're really simple. And it came from, I think, maybe Paradise School that I had gotten that. And so I made some of these, and my students did too. But the principle of repetition, there's repeated lines and shapes, and a repeated pattern is called a motif. And so I use this as the stars motif on this one. So we have these stars as the motif that carries that picture. And we use motifs everywhere. I see some of these, most of the ladies here are wearing dresses that have a pattern on. Well, that's a motif. What if you had some of the stripes running this way and some running that way and some running diagonally and, or the flowers, it would just all kinds of different things. Well, sometimes you see people wearing these T-shirts they call tie-dyed, and that looks like somebody's playing paintball with a T-shirt and then put it on. And so it's kind of this is who I am type of thing, tie-dyed. Say, look, I like whatever. And so this is the opposite of that. We believe in a pattern that repeats a motif. And motifs are useful in other forms too. You're probably familiar with the concept of motifs in music too. So when you write a melody, you have a certain repeated pattern that you repeat throughout the song. And we're familiar with that. We actually get in trouble sometimes when the song takes a turn a little away from the motif. And they often do that about the third bar where the artist chose, you take a little different pattern, but then what happens in the last one? You go back to your pattern again, see? That's to give, well, I'm getting a little ahead of my subject here, but it gives you unity as well as variety. So much for motifs. We also have contrast. Both of these Both of these pictures show contrast with the silhouettes and the yellow on the blue, in this case, the yellow on the purple here. And so we have contrast there of colors, but there's other kinds of contrast too. You can have larger, smaller. You can have thick or thin. There's lots of different kinds of contrast, not just color. Then we have another kind of, especially want to look at repetition and rhythm here. So you could make straight vertical lines, or you can make straight horizontal lines, or you can make slanting lines. So the idea of rhythm is the slanting lines give you kind of dynamic. It makes you feel active. If you just had static, straight up and down or left and right, that wouldn't give you that same feeling of movement. Whereas the slanting sun rays that come down here, and actually these diverge as well, that gives you a realistic feel, but also a feeling of movement, of dynamism. And I guess somebody got funny and put some little droplets falling off the end bleeding heart here that way too. Now, I wanted to show you something else here. So this was my art. And I know it's not that great of a job. This is about the best art I can do, so I'm pretty simple. But anyhow, let's look at this one. God's artwork. That's what God made. I took a picture of that in my wife's flower bed this spring. And I think that's a whole lot better than any art that man could do, period. So, and I think it's just a beautiful, the bleeding hearts when they're in that nice curve like that, I just think it's so pretty. Now, I want to spend a little time talking about symmetry here. All right. Think of an animal. There's various kinds of symmetry. So I just want to talk about this a little bit because it's a very important principle of design and also patterns in nature. Let's take this tiger. Is there symmetry? Is the tiger symmetrical? Yes, he is symmetrical, right? So if you would take this tiger, and you can look at what they call bilateral symmetry. So if you took this tiger and you divided him in half, starting at the nose, going the whole way, cutting him in half, the whole way back through, and down to the tip of the tail, you'd have two halves of a tiger. Would they be equal? Would they be the same, both halves? Sure they are. Both halves would have an eye, an ear, whiskers, half of a nose. You'd have a front paw leg, and you'd have a back paw leg, and half of a tail. Now, the insides, I don't know that that's necessarily perfectly balanced in half, but this is a symmetrical creature. What if it was missing whatever, a limb or something? Or what if it was deformed in some way? Well, that would be asymmetrical. So asymmetrical in a creature like that would not be real beautiful. We would say that's a misshapen creature. And sometimes creatures are born like that. What? A calf with two heads, or you know, there's crazy stuff happens sometimes. And then we say, well, they're not beautiful because they're asymmetrical, misshapen. Now, not only tigers, but we have symmetry in butterflies. Again, if you would divide the butterfly this way, you could have, I want to say this, you could of course transversely divide the tiger and just chop him in half right here. Then you still have two halves of a tiger, but they would not be exactly equal, right? The front half would have the head and all those parts, and the back half would have the tail and all those parts. But there is a symmetry that back and forth, that because you have two halves. Same thing with the butterflies here, that you could divide them as well. We'll talk about, I think there's more about butterflies later. In plants, we have monocots, and monocots have flower parts in threes or sixes. So let me see. I think this one is 18, and I think this one is 12, if I'm remembering right anyway. So they're either three or six or multiples of those. So these are monocots. I think this is a Mexican sunflower maybe here. This might be a dahlia. And these are dicots then. So we have a spring beauty here, and you can see that it has five. So there are parts of four or five, those would be dicots. And this one you can't see. The fifth one is down here on this violet hanging below there. That's from my woods this spring too. Now, I wanted to, Andrew, what time am I supposed to be done?
Around 12. Well, I think you want lunch before.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about the Fibonacci sequence a little bit, and there's maybe too much math here. I probably can't really cover this effectively, but the Fibonacci sequence, this is part of it here. Whoops, hit the wrong one. So what it is you take the two numbers, like here, 3 and 5, and I think I missed a number there. I missed 2. 2 should be right here. But anyway, let's go to the 3 and the 5. So the 3 and the 5 totaled together equal 8. The 5 and 8 added together equal 13. The 8 and the 13 added together equal 21. Okay, what's the number in the blank? How are you going to find it? What numbers you add to get the number in the blank? All right, you're going to add these two together. And let me see, I don't actually have the number on my paper. Somebody did the math. 233? I think that is the right number. I think that is the right number, 233. Now, the ratio of these numbers, if you divide them out, like I've used an example of 55 and 89 here. If you put the 50, make a fraction with 55 at the top and 89 in the bottom, it has a ratio of 0.6179 or approximately 0.618. And that's, of course, always the same. If you flip it around and put the big number on the top, numerator and denominator type of thing, you make the 89 the numerator and 55 the denominator, you have a ratio of 1.618. And this results in, these proportions are called the golden ratio or the divine proportion. And they yield a rectangle, like you can have the golden rectangle, and it would, the sides, the ratio of the sides in the golden rectangle would have this ratio. And so here's a diagram that was in the Christian School Builder a few months ago, showing how they can achieve the logarithmic spiral by using multiple and smaller golden ratios in this rectangle here. Now you say, well, what's that to do with nature? Well, where can you see something like this? Well, it has a lot to do with nature at all. It really does. I understand. I think the orbits of the revolution of the planets, I think, is in the same ratio. You might see it in the spirals. These are fossils. Again, my son's fossils. But you see how this spirals around here. And if you ever studied, if you never studied about a chamber nautilus, you ought to. And you ought to read Oliver Wendell Holmes' poem about the chamber nautilus, because that's well worth your time. And it's a beautiful poem and an interesting creature. But anyway, that'd be something like this. Then here's another fossil like this. I don't even know what they call that one, but it's a spiral shell. And then you can see it in, does that look like a spiral there? This is scanned from the School Builder cover. Can you see the spiral as you look at that? So the seeds are arranged in this spiral motion. This, of course, is a fern fiddlehead, and you see the spiral there as well. So it's a pattern in nature that results from a mathematical ratio. There'd be a lot of things like that if you could only penetrate them, if you only knew enough math to do that. I understand that the arrangement of leaves around a plant stem, leaves now, not the flower, but the arrangement of leaves around a plant stem is also in this arrangement, spiral arrangement, and that the purpose for that is to maximize the amount of sunlight that can hit the leaves. And the evolutionists say, well, yeah, that evolved so that the plant could collect the most sunlight. And when I hear things like that, it kind of goes like this inside, because I hate it. It's wrong. And God made it. God designed it that way so the plant could survive and make the best use of the energy coming to it. This Fibonacci sequence applies from the mighty to the small. The time period of revolution of the planets to the DNA in everyone's body. It's in there. I'm saying God created these principles. Well, then, God created variety. And I've got two different kinds of variety here, but God created variety. Think of the seasons, the weather, the variety of the landscapes, the variety of birds, 10,000 kinds of birds, animals, trees, flowers, the palette of colors we see. And sometimes they say, well, this display can display so many million colors. And I think, Yeah, great, that's a super nice display, but to me, the greater thing than that this display can display millions of colors is that my eyes can see those millions of colors and distinguish between them. To me, that's far greater than a display that can replicate those, but my eyes can see them. We can look at the tiger again. This is a black swallowtail. We hatched one year, and when that thing crawled out, it was gorgeous. I mean, really black, and the colors were just popping. It was just stunning, and it sat there a while. You know how they do, and they dry out and everything, and it was just so nice to see, and it's just amazing how God has made those wings. But there's variety there. Then we have another thing, not only variety, but God has made unity. And in the case of unity, all the elements fit together. They make a consistent, harmonious whole, just like a beautiful song that's perfectly written in the harmony. If everything were perfectly symmetrical, the world would be too bland. And if everything were just a confused jumble of variety, why, we'd have too much variety and no rest, too much change all the time. But God has balanced symmetry, repetition, and variety to create a unity that we enjoy. This one is to express unity, and I think it is at the circle here. I thought about this. I wasn't intending this to be patriotic at all. That's not the purpose here. But it says, righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And so there we have isn't it saying that true unity comes when people follow God's way? And so you can make your own conclusions. I don't think I need to say any more about politics. All right, that's the basis of beauty. I want to think about some expressions of beauty. So we see the macro environment. That's a Webb Space Telescope picture. Maybe you have that one, Brother Mark. That's Carina, I think it is called. You can go on and download pictures from the Webb Space Telescope. I think NASA has them available. There's actually maybe sub-sites that you can get them from. But you're actually looking at, what, probably billions of miles in that picture. It's just a tremendous. I always like that picture. But anyway, the mighty to the small. We have the ocean's roar. This one is from the U.S. Virgin Islands. I think my son took that one. This one's from Guatemala. One evening we were out there at the Pacific Ocean. So the ocean's roar, you can just about hear that. The big things, the mountains, thinking about the big things in Earth. This is Grand Tetons in Wyoming. This is in Washington, the Cascades. And you see the green water here. How many of you ever saw that green water like that? The green water actually comes from, particles that get dissolved in the snow when it melts. This was in the summer. It was late in the summer, so the snow caps are pretty small. But the Cascades get big snow caps. And then when that melts, the particles wash down off the mountains and go into water and make it green like that. I never saw water like that green. From the viewing platform, look down, it's just amazing, that color green. I don't think I captured it quite as what it really looks like. But anyhow, I'm talking about the big things. Oh, I wanted to show this one yet, too. That's Mount Rainier. And we were traveling, and it was cloudy, and we stopped where we were supposed to see Mount Rainier. Total blank, just obscured by clouds, nothing there. And then as we either drove on further or waited, this is on the other side of it, then the clouds kind of dissipated somewhat, and the cone of it stuck out there. We could see it. So anyway, that was an enjoyable moment when we could actually see the mountain. Then we have the micro environment. I don't have much time for this, but when you get smaller too, not only big, but when you get small, you have a leaf, you have a cell. I like to see leaves, and I have a hammock underneath some trees, and I just love to lie there in my hammock and look up and see the trees. And it's especially nice when the sun kind of filters through the leaves. And I look up there, and often I think, every leaf up there is a miracle. It's just incredible. If you look at a cross-section of a leaf, and I don't have one, I should have scanned one, but I didn't. Every leaf is just amazing, and it's creating life. We couldn't survive without it. It's part of taking the transition of energy from sunlight into food that we can eat. And so it's an amazing thing that God has created. And yet there's millions of them. The poet says, there are 10,000 leaves in every tree, and each a miracle to me. So when you dig deeper and you go into the molecules, last night we looked at the structure of a molecule related to the fluorescent rocks. Well, that structure and design is also beautiful in its own way. And today we have microscopes that we can look deeper and we can see electrons and electron microscopes and so on. We can see things at the atomic level. And there we see beauty as well. I mentioned the DNA. So everyday beauty, I just want to think a little bit about everyday beauty, things we can see. Joyce Kilmer, the poet, he said, I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. And so I had these two trees. I thought, well, this was in the spring, and I just love the spring green colors at our house. We love the spring green colors. And then, you know, when it rains, the trunks get all black like that, get all dark, and it's just a really nice contrast. This is in the fall. I'm afraid maybe some of those are some of my white ash trees, and you know what they look like now. They all fell down, and unfortunately, but they had a beautiful orangey-red leaf. I think that is what that is. Consider the lilies, Jesus said, and so don't miss the beauty of the wildflowers. What I like is to go for a walk in the woods in the springtime and look at the ephemerals, these little flowers that come up and bloom for a little while, and then they disappear. And so I've got a couple of these here, the spring beauty. And I just, if you go in the woods at the right time, the whole woods floor is covered with spring beauty. And they're little. I mean, you can just ignore them if you want to, but if you're out there looking for them, why, there's a carpet of these things on the woods floor. And that's one reason I have a woods, because I love to walk in the woods and see these things in the spring. And then, of course, you have this bloodroot here, another one of these that comes up, blooms for a short time, and then goes away again. I think I'm going to have to move on here. Maybe we have the trees. I would love to read the poem Loveliest of Trees, but I don't have time to read it. One of my favorite poems. But let's keep moving. Birds. We have the Baltimore Oriole there. We have the pileated woodpecker there. It came to our pine cone feeder there. That's a female there. But anyway, it's quite an impressive bird. These are from our trip to Bolivia last year. We have the parakeet, the yellow chevron parakeet here. And we have macaw. This was actually sort of a tame macaw there, but they're certainly a very beautiful creature there in their plumage. We have the sky. Do you watch the sky? This is not too long ago. The sky had a strange effect. It was really dark blue up top here. The sun was setting, and it was like striped. You had the sunset here, and then you had this dark blue with this high clouds in it, and it just kind of made an interesting picture. This is from our Bolivia trip too, and down there in Bolivia they have beautiful skies. A lot of days it's just pretty like this, with blue sky and lots of cloudy little clouds, puffy clouds in it. And do we observe the skies and see the skies? A daily scene. And of course we can see sunsets. This one is in Utah, somewhere near the Great Salt Lake. This one is also in Bolivia, at one of our friends down there at their place. So there's beauty that we can see. I wanted to talk about snowflakes, but I think I'll just have to flip over these. These are in a book by Kenneth Liebrecht or something, I think it is. I didn't bring it along, I should have. But he's got some phenomenal pictures of snowflakes in there that show the actual, the way they are inside. Says here, a typical snow crystal measures about 1 to 2 millimeters in diameter, just large enough to fit inside the letter O printed here. So, and if you watch a little, if you take out a black piece of paper or something black, maybe glass, and put something black behind it that's cold, then you can actually sometimes get photographs that, without a lot of special equipment, of the snowflake seeing its crystal form. So he had special stuff, and he had made some special pictures here, but I'm not going to talk about that. I want to talk about the hummingbird just a little bit here, if I may. May I talk about the hummingbird? Are you okay if I talk about the hummingbird? Okay. This book was on our shelf at home. It's called Amazing Hummingbirds by Stan Tequila. I don't know if that's a name you're familiar with or not, but Stan Tequila has written different books about birds and wildlife. Really good writer. A lot of good facts. I'm sorry, evolutionary though, so you got to keep on guard for that. It's like, I just can't understand this. How can these people see this stuff and say all these wonderful things, and then at the end they say, well, this evolved because of that. Ah, it's like, How can you get further from the truth that way? But anyhow, this one here in particular, these aren't the greatest pictures, but I must be supposed to quit here. I don't have a pointer anymore. But anyhow, this one came to our feeder. I'm sorry. I can. Well, no, I will do that then. But I don't know about pointing. But anyway, this was a hummingbird that came and stayed the winter at our place here in Pennsylvania. And the Rufous hummingbird is not around here. And normally it's the ruby-throateds that we have. And that year, the Rufous was there. As an immature, you can see in that picture, it's just a couple of little gorget feathers there. There's orange ones. And so he was not a mature bird. And somehow must have got blown off his course and showed up at the feeder. And he stayed during the winter. I mean, my wife was out there putting the syrup out there, like it would get to 20 degrees and the stuff in the feeder would freeze. So you bring that one in, thaw it out, put the next one out, and this fellow would keep coming. And all winter we kept him going like that. And he was at the neighbors too. And the people were coming to see it. I mean, they would come in our backyard and set up their cameras and shoot toward the house and take pictures of this thing. And it was kind of an interesting time that way. Could tell you more stories, but I guess we'll keep moving. This is the smallest bird, but among the most remarkable to me. A hummingbird, if there's anything that would refute evolution, it's a hummingbird. And they are very small. We have the ruby-throated here in Pennsylvania, and that bird weighs 2.7 to 3 grams is how much. It's just very little. And they can eat half as much as half of their weight in a day and drink 8 times their weight in water. Some of them do. They can come here and sip for a while. But they lose body heat fast, so they can go into what's called torpor, and then they go to slower metabolism, and their bodies have actually been measured down to 38 degrees, that the body temp dropped to 38 degrees. That's how cold they can get and still survive. They almost seem lifeless. Now, the flight is probably one of the most interesting things. They can fly backward, forward, upside down. And why is that? It's because God created hummingbirds with a special large muscle, breastbone muscle, a large breastbone and large muscles. And so they actually have, most birds, they raise their wings and flap down. But a hummingbird can flap down and up. It has a special muscle that can allow it to flap up. So that enables it to flap both ways, and so that gives it some of its acrobatics abilities. And 25% of the body weight is in these muscles. And I've read, I think Tequila says this, 80 to 200 flaps per second they can do. And that's why it kind of buzzes, because they're flapping that fast. How many of you saw the hummingbird flying its arc ever? You ever observed a hummingbird? A few people, not too many. If you have hummingbirds, you can watch them, and the male does this to impress the females. And what they'll do is we often see them in the backyard, and they'll be there going like this, and sometimes the arc is real little, just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then sometimes the arc is the whole backyard. I mean, they'll be making a big swoop like this. And the whole idea is they're out to impress the females and say, see what a good flyer I am. That's the idea anyway. I guess that's true. Never ask one. But it is interesting to watch them do it. How fast can they fly? 20 to 30 miles per hour and up to 60 miles per hour. What's impressive is the heart rate. They say that resting heart rate for a hummingbird can be as much as 500 beats a minute, and that's 8 per second. But when they're flying, they claim that the heart rate can go up to 1,200 beats a minute. I imagine how God could make something do that. It's just incredible. The breath rate, 250 a minute, so that little birdie is really pumping. And yet, these birds migrate far. This little Rufous hummingbird that's up here, one day it disappeared, so I don't know. We hope nothing got it. We really were hoping that it safely got somewhere else. It's almost the kind of thing you feel sad when they depart, because you never see that one again. But anyway, they migrate up to 2,500 miles from Alaska to Central America. That little bird. Well, I think one of the neatest things. Is the hummingbird's feathers. These are posters from the Cornell University. They have a publication called Living Bird Magazine. Cornell's extremely evolutionary, but some of these publications are pretty interesting. I really want to talk about this. These are called the gems because they all have names of different gems, and that ties into my talk last night. But here, what I want to show you is over here in the right, you have the way they create that special iridescence in the gorget. I mean, or other parts of the hummingbird too. And it, excuse me, it is because the hummingbird feathers are actually thicker. They're actually thicker than other feathers. And they have multiple layers of these things called melanosomes. So that as light rays penetrate the barbule, and the top melanosome, some reflects off, and some goes deeper, reflects off of that melanosome, and some go deeper yet, reflects off of that, and is reflected in different colors. Also, your angle of vision is here. You're looking at it this way, the angle of the light and the vision that you're looking at it. Because you know how a gorget of a hummingbird can look really red under sunlight and perfectly black under another one. Well, you know it didn't actually change from red to black necessarily. It's just the way that the light is reflecting off of that. So this writer in Living Bird magazine said, this is extremely complex. He said many colors produced by hummingbirds are based on a combination of peaks, one in the blue and another in the UV spectrum. Who knew? That same writer says how to develop two reflectance peaks based on the same structure is something we still do not understand fully. That amazes me. And yet he concludes his article by saying, well, this evolved because of so and so and so. I'm like, how could it be? But anyway, so what is the highest expression of God's creative ability? Man himself. You can see one just by looking around you. I'm looking at 100 of them. We're all God's, in the image of God. Well, the appreciation of beauty, I don't have time for this. I just want to say this. The Bible says, stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. And why don't we see as much of nature's beauty as we should? Why? It's because we're not standing still. We're going and going and going. Now, I'm really glad that all of you took time out of your schedules to come here today and think about enjoying nature. I think God is pleased with that. I think God wants us to do that. And so I'm glad you did that. But in your family life, you can help your children by taking interest in nature. Get books for all right, I'm not going to go into that because you probably know all the things. And I'm telling you, you can buy all kinds of expensive equipment, but if you don't go out there and look, that equipment isn't going to do you one bit of good. You're better off using your eyes that you have and not having that equipment than having equipment you don't use. So I'm not saying you shouldn't have equipment. Some things require equipment, like I had my UV lights. But I'm just trying to encourage, let's take the time. Do we take the time to take a walk in the woods and stop by woods in a snowy evening to listen to the bird songs that you recognize them and say, oh, well, that somebody came down the other day and said, oh, what's that bird? Somebody who's normally at her place. And, well, it was a Carolina wren. And those things that's a little bird with a big voice, I like to say. It sounds like it's inside the house sometimes. But anyway, do you take time to observe the mysteries of a snowflake or the beauty of a rose? And have you considered the miracles that are around you every day and enjoy the variety that we have? And thank God for it. This is a song, God and God Alone. God and God alone created all these things we call our own. From the mighty to the small, the glory in them all is God's and God's alone.